also ask for what they need, and they don't put up with a lot of crap. I lived the opposite way. I assumed that people were not doing their best, so I judged them and constantly fought being disappointed, which is easier than setting boundaries. Boundaries are hard. They're especially hard when you want to be liked and when you're a people pleaser, hell-bent on being fun and easy and flexible. Compassionate people ask for what they need. They say no when they need to, and when they say yes, they mean it. They're compassionate because their boundaries keep them out of resentment. When asked to speak at the event, I said yes when I wanted to say no. I put no value on my work or my needs, and the event organizers, in turn, put no value on my work or my needs. You know the irony about speaking fees? When I do something for full fee, people are respectful and professional. When I do something pro bono because I care about the cause, people are so respectful and professional. When I do something because I feel pushed, pressured, guilt-tripped, or shamed into it, I expect people to be appreciative in addition to being respectful and professional. Yet 90% of the time, they are none of the above. This is the question. How can we expect people to put value on our work when we don't value ourselves enough to set and hold uncomfortable boundaries? I told Diana about taking the question even further with a group of clergy who serve rural families living in poverty. I described how I'd asked these men and women to think of someone they find themselves judging and holding resentment toward, and to write that person's name on a piece of paper. Then I asked them to pretend with me for a minute. What if you had it on the highest authority that the person whose name you wrote down is doing the very best that he or she can do? There was immediate resistance. I don't believe it. Who is the authority? This was easy. These were clergy. I said, God said so. One woman burst into tears. She and her husband were sitting next to each other. They were both deacons, and, without conferring, they had written down the same person's name. I asked her if she felt like sharing what she was feeling with the group. James, the person they both referenced, was a man with 6 young children who lived in a trailer in the desert. Both he and his wife had long addiction histories, and children's services had been in and out of their lives for years. The clergy brought James and his family food, diapers, and baby formula on a regular basis, but they were convinced that he sold the goods for drinking money at least as often as he used them for his family. In a shaky voice, she said, "If God told me that James was doing the best he can, I would do one of 2 things. I would continue to bring him what I could, when I could, and withhold judgment. Or I would decide that giving anything directly to James is not something I can continue to do. Either way, I would need to stop being so angry, stop judging, and stop waiting for something different to happen." Her husband put his arm around her. Fighting back his own tears, he looked at the group and said, "We're just so tired. So tired of being angry and feeling taken for granted." Diana listened intently, and when I was done, she said, "You're right. This is hard and important work for you." This time, I felt my face and heart opening up. Yes, it's hard. And I'm tired. But the tired I feel from doing this kind of exploration is different than the tired I feel from being pissed off and resentful all of the time. It's a good tired, not a cream gravy tired. The reckoning. That feeling of self-righteousness in the airport triggered the real reckoning for me. My face-down moment happened when I was standing in line, thinking hateful and judgmental thoughts about every person around me and, on the surface, feeling superior. I say on the surface because I've studied judgment and I know we don't judge people when we feel good about ourselves. I knew something was wrong. There was a smaller reckoning when I was white-knuckling my luggage and watching my roommate walk from the icing-stained couch to the smoking patio. like skilled poker players assess their opponents, I've studied my own tells, and I know I'm knee-deep in emotion or vulnerability whenever my prayers include not wanting to hurt someone or when I'm rehearsing really mean conversations. But ultimately, my curiosity about those debilitating feelings of self-righteousness led me to make that appointment with Diana from the airplane. The Rumble. I started my SFD in my journal on the plane ride home. It was mostly bulleted points and colored pencil doodles, and the icing wiper portrayed as the devil. My SFD was pretty straightforward and, embarrassingly, approximated a temper tantrum. I was easy and flexible, against my will, and instead of being appreciative, the event organizers took advantage of me. I was good, they were bad, it wasn't fair, and I did not deserve it. I also jotted down a basic theory on two general types of human behavior. Type one, those of us who try our very best, follow the rules, and are respectful. Type two, the sewer rats and scofflaws of the world who don't try their best and who take advantage of people. Once I got home, I added to my SFD that it's not fair that I can't eat, spend, or do what I want to comfort myself after a hard trip like that. This draft had no shortage of not fairs. I had to rumble with the shame of being high maintenance, my self-worth, blame, resentment, and perfectionism, my normal haunts. But the biggest rumble was with boundaries, self-righteousness, and integrity. The delta between the confabulations in my SFD and the truth was dark, wide, and swampy. I came away with these key learnings. We're all doing the best we can. The sewer rats and scofflaws lens is a dangerous way to view the world, because no matter how hard you're working or how many balls you can keep in the air, if you look at the world through that lens long enough, you'll eventually see yourself as a little rodent in a biker jacket. Another key learning is that the trick to staying out of resentment is maintaining better boundaries, blaming others less, and holding myself more accountable for asking for what I need and want. The next key learning is that there is no integrity in blaming and turning to, it's not fair and I deserve. I need to take responsibility for my own well-being. If I believed I was not being treated fairly or not getting something I deserved, was I actually asking for it, or was I just looking for an excuse to assign blame and feel self-righteous? The next key learning, I am trying not to numb my discomfort for myself because I think I'm worth that effort. It's not something that's happening to me. It's something I'm choosing for myself. Last, this rumble taught me why self-righteousness is dangerous. Most of us buy into the myth that it's a long fall from I'm better than you to I'm not good enough. But the truth is that these are two sides of the same coin. Both are attacks on our worthiness. We don't compare when we're feeling good about ourselves. We look for what's good in others. When we practice self-compassion, we are compassionate toward others. Self-righteousness is just the armor of self-loathing. In Daring Greatly, I talk about how the lyrics of Leonard Cohen's song, Hallelujah, love is not a victory march, it's a cold and it's a broken hallelujah, capture how Daring Greatly can feel more like freedom with a little battle fatigue than a full-on celebration. The same is true for Rising Strong. What I've learned from the research and my own experiences is that the Rising Strong process deepens our wholeheartedness, but it often feels like a good, hearty, tired. A closer look at rumbling with boundaries, integrity, and generosity. My formal research continues to bear out the patterns I observed when I informally asked people whether they believe others are doing the best they can. I've now asked hundreds of people the question and documented and coded their responses. I've done the exercises that I did with the deacons at 20 large conferences. Folks write down the name of someone who fills them with frustration, disappointment, and/or resentment. And then I propose that their person is doing the best he or she can. Their responses have been wide-ranging. "Crap," one man said. "If he's really doing the best he can, I'm a total jerk, and I need to stop harassing him and start helping him." One woman said, "If this was true, and my mother was doing the best she can, I would be grief-stricken. I'd rather be angry than sad. It's easier to believe she's letting me down on purpose than to grieve the fact that my mother is never going to be who I need her to be." It can be painful for organization leaders to answer this question because, as with the first comment, what often comes up is the realization that instead of prodding and pushing someone, they need to move on to the difficult task of helping them, reassigning them, or letting them go. As miserable as resentment, disappointment, and frustration make us feel, we fool ourselves into believing that they are easier than the vulnerability of a difficult conversation. Judgment and anger take up way more emotional bandwidth for us. Beyond that, they are often shaming and disrespectful to the person who is struggling, and ultimately toxic to the entire culture. One of the most profound responses to this exercise came out of a focus group I did with a group of leaders at West Point. One officer pushed me a little on the accuracy of the intel and kept asking, "Are you 100% certain that this person is doing the best he can?" After I answered yes two or three times, the officer took a deep breath and said, "Then move the rock." I was confused. "What do you mean by move the rock?" He shook his head. "I have to stop kicking the rock. I need to move it. It's hurting both of us. He's not the right person for this position, and there's no amount of pushing or getting on him that's going to change that. He needs to be reassigned to a position where he can make a contribution." This doesn't mean that we stop helping people set goals or that we stop expecting people to grow and change. It means that we stop respecting and evaluating people based on what we think they should accomplish and start respecting them for who they are and holding them accountable for what they're actually doing. It means that we stop loving people for who they could be and start loving them for who they are. It means that sometimes, when we're beating ourselves up, we need to stop and say to that harassing voice inside, "Man, I'm doing the very best I can right now." Living big, boundaries, integrity, generosity. Jean Kintambu Lading, a professor in my master's and doctoral program, was one of my most important mentors. She taught leadership and organizational development. I interned with her, did leadership and organizational development research under her supervision, and served as a teaching assistant in her leadership classes. Whenever someone would bring up a conflict with a colleague, she would ask, "What is the hypothesis of generosity? What is the most generous assumption you can make about this person's intentions or what this person said?" You know, based on how I was raised and my relationship with vulnerability at the time, I never thought all that highly of this idea. I always thought it was like asking, "What's the best way to get sucker punched in this situation?" But now, as I started working from the new intention that people are doing their best, I remember Jean's question and started applying it in my life. If someone sent me a curt email, I would try to generously hypothesize that he was having a crappy day, or that he's not a great email communicator, or that maybe his actual tone didn't translate over email. Whatever the case, it wasn't about me. This was incredibly effective and liberating, to a point. Generosity is not a free pass for people to take advantage of us, treat us unfairly, or be purposefully disrespectful and mean. What I realized was that a generous assumption without boundaries is another recipe for resentment, misunderstanding, and judgment. We could all stand to be more generous, but we also need to maintain our integrity and our boundaries. I call the solution to this issue living big, boundaries, integrity, and generosity. Here's the question. What boundaries do I need to put in place so I can work from a place of integrity and extend the most generous interpretations of the intentions, words, and actions of others? Setting boundaries means getting clear on what behaviors are okay and what's not okay. Integrity is key to this commitment because it's how we set those boundaries and ultimately hold ourselves and others accountable for respecting them. I tried to find an existing definition of integrity that reflected what I saw in the data, but I couldn't. So here's my definition. Integrity is choosing courage over comfort, choosing what is right over what is fun, fast or easy, and choosing to practice our values rather than simply professing them. Living big is saying, yes, I'm going to be generous in my assumptions and intentions while standing solidly in my integrity and being very clear about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. In the Lake Travis story, I ultimately approached Steve with the assumption that he loved me and that there was something going on that I didn't fully understand and that it was worth being vulnerable and putting my feelings and fears on the table. Being honest about the stories we're making up versus just acting on our anger or self-protective impulses is a generous move. I was rooted in my integrity, choosing what I felt was brave and right over what was comfortable and easy. And I was addressing an issue that felt like a boundary violation. It's not okay to blow me off when I'm trying to reach out. Steve responded the same way. He told me the truth, held me accountable for past behavior, and stayed in his integrity. Living big saved us that morning. Had either one of us assumed the worst, defaulted to the easy route, or gone into self-protection or attack mode, it would be a different, albeit familiar, story. One of the best examples of living big comes from my friend Kelly Ray Roberts. Kelly Ray is an artist, teacher, and entrepreneur. Over the past 5 or 6 years, her art has exploded in popularity. If you look at her website, many of you will recognize it and say, "Oh, I love her work." In addition to making art, Kelly Ray runs her business, is a writer, and teaches multimedia painting courses. Interestingly, she was working as a social worker in the oncology department of a hospital when she taught herself how to paint and draw. She later followed her calling to become an artist and an entrepreneur, and is now generously committed to helping others do the same. As Kelly Ray's career took off and she began licensing her work globally, she began to run into problems. Large-scale copyright infringement started happening. This is an unrelenting issue for many artists. And she began noticing that some of her blog followers and students from her classes were copying her art and selling it online. Kelly Ray responded to these legal breaches with one of the most powerful examples of living big that I've ever seen. She wrote a blog post titled, "What is and is not okay?" The post was kind, generous, explicit, straightforward, and unflinching. Here's an edited version. "It's not okay to use one of my images as your profile photo on Facebook or any other website without an artist credit. This violates copyright law. It's not okay to make copies of the art instructions from my book, articles, or classes and publish them to your blogs and websites. It's also not okay to reword my instructions and use them for a class you are teaching for profit or to submit them to magazines for publication. It's not okay to publish videos or photos on your blogs and websites showing my book, class step-by-step instructions, or painting process. It is okay to be inspired, to experiment, to learn techniques and then to make them your own. The techniques shared in my book, articles, and classes are meant to be jumping off points for you so you can keep going, expand, grow, totally okay, and celebrate it. It is okay to send me an email asking if you can use one of my images for any reason. It is okay to grab images from my website for a blog post, but you must give credit. The entire post, which is much longer than what I'm sharing here, and even includes a frequently asked questions section, was framed with this message. I hope this helps clear things up. I know that most people who have crossed the line have done so without intention, and most didn't mean any harm whatsoever. But I think it's important that we all continue to be good stewards of the creative life and continue to gently educate on what's appropriate and what's not, especially because breaking copyright law is very serious. As Kelly Ray so beautifully demonstrated, boundaries are simply our lists of what's okay and what's not okay. In fact, this is the working definition I use for boundaries today. It's so straightforward, and it makes sense for all ages in all situations. When we combine the courage to make clear what works for us and what doesn't, with the compassion to assume people are doing their best, our lives change. Yes, there will be people who violate our boundaries, and this will require that we continue to hold those people accountable. But when we're living in our integrity, we're strengthened by the self-respect that comes from the honoring of our boundaries, rather than being flattened by disappointment and resentment. One of the greatest gifts of this work is how it's changed my parenting. Now, when my kids come home from school and talk about how someone has been unfair or how a classmate continually treats them badly, I have a new approach. I will listen with empathy and ask about their part in the issue, but now we also explore the question, what boundaries need to be in place so that you can stay in your integrity and make generous assumptions about this person's motivation, intentions, or behaviors? Recently, my daughter and I were having this conversation about someone acting out on social media. When I asked my daughter how we could apply living big to the situation, a look of concern washed over her face. She said, "A generous assumption would be that she's really hurting, not just looking for attention." I agreed. We talked about how Ellen wants to maintain her integrity online, and then did the tough work of making a list of what's okay and what's not okay. Finally, we discussed how she was going to set these boundaries and expectations and hold people accountable for them. Both Ellen and Charlie have asked a lot of questions about the appropriateness of setting boundaries when someone is hurting. It's hard enough for me to get my head and heart around the relationship between boundaries and compassion. But just imagine how strange it must be for kids being raised in a culture with very few models of how boundary setting and kindness can coexist. I believe it comes down to a simple question. Can you be kind and respectful to your friend if he or she is hurting you? The answer is no, and this leads to a couple of choices. The easy solution is to be unkind and disrespectful back, or to walk away. The courageous answer is to look at this friend and say, "I care about you, and I'm sorry that you're going through a hard time, but I need to talk to you about what's okay and what's not okay." The permutations of this example are endless and stretch across every part of our lives. I know the holidays are hard for you. I want you to come over on Christmas Eve and be with us, but I'm not comfortable with you drinking so much that you get drunk. I understand that there's a lot of conflict between you and one of the other team members. This is a stressful project, and it's miserable for all of us who work under this constant tension. It's not sustainable. I need you to clean it up by next week, or you'll be pulled off the team. What's your preference, and how can I support you? Yes, I love you. Yes, I made bad choices when I was your age. And yes, you're still grounded. A note on serial killers, terrorists, and assassins. I should win the most likely to be asked about serial killers, terrorists, and assassins award. For the past decade, when I've said there's no convincing evidence that shame is an effective compass for moral behavior, everyone from students to journalists hits me with the question, "What about the murderers?" To which I respond, "Shame is much more likely to be the cause of destructive behavior than the cure." Guilt and empathy are the emotions that lead us to question how our actions affect other people, and both of these are severely diminished by the presence of shame. Do I believe that serial killers and terrorists are doing the best they can? Yes. And their best is dangerous, which is why I believe we should catch them, lock them up, and assess whether they can be helped. If they can't, they should stay locked up. That's how compassion and accountability work. Hold people accountable for their actions in a way that acknowledges their humanity. When we treat people like animals and then expect them to emerge from prison, newly minted as loving, empathic, connected people, we're kidding ourselves. Requiring accountability while also extending your compassion is not the easiest course of action, but it is the most humane and ultimately the safest for our community. The revolution. Character. The willingness to accept responsibility for one's own life is the source from which self-respect springs. Joan Didion. I have moved from the self-righteousness and resentment of my shitty first draft to a new way of looking at the world. Maria Popova, founder of the wonderfully curated website brainpickings.org, recently shared an essay on self-respect by Joan Didion that includes the quote I just read. It brought so many feelings into focus for me. In my new story, I am clear on the fact that self-righteousness is a tremendous threat to self-respect. As Didion points out, I must accept responsibility for my own life and my decisions. When I was finding fault with everyone who walked by that day at the airport, my self-respect was suffering. That's why things felt so dark. I agreed to do something for someone for the wrong reasons. I wasn't being generous or kind. I said yes to be likable and to avoid being seen as difficult. Moving forward, I give myself permission to ask for what I need, to take care of myself. I can never be sure about the intentions of others, but I believe that assuming the best about other people can fundamentally change my life. I now recognize that people learn how to treat us based on how they see us treating ourselves. If I don't put value on my work or my time, neither will the person I'm helping. Boundaries are a function of self-respect and self-love. Even on the rare occasion when living big leaves me feeling vulnerable, I'm still left standing squarely in my integrity. From there, all things are possible. We can't rise strong when we're on the run. Chapter 7. The Brave and Broken-Hearted. Rumbling with expectations, disappointment, resentment, heartbreak, connection, grief, forgiveness, compassion, and empathy. Claudia reached out to me after attending a talk I gave on the Rising Strong research. She had recently had a difficult family experience that she was struggling to process, and, she explained, several of the pieces fell into place as she listened to me speak. She generously agreed to be interviewed for the book and has allowed me to share her story. Claudia is in her early 30s, 5 years into an exciting and promising career in design, newly married, and in the process of fixing up a new home in an up-and-coming neighborhood on Chicago's north side. She is smart, funny, kind, and radiant. Claudia explained that she and her husband had decided to split up for their first Thanksgiving as a married couple so they could each spend time with their own families. They didn't have much time off from work, and both were overdue for visits, so she headed to Madison, Wisconsin, while he took off for Milwaukee. Going home for the holidays is fraught with emotion for a lot of people, and it had never been easy for Claudia. Her youngest sister, Amy, suffers from depression and alcoholism. Amy's drinking problems began in high school. She first got sober when she was 18, but over the next 10 years, she'd bounce back and forth between relapses and further treatment. Now, in her late 20s, Amy was drinking again, and this time refusing to get help. She couldn't hold down a steady job and was fighting with her parents, her only source of support. Even though they had rented an apartment in Madison for her, Amy refused to live there because it meant having to answer questions about her health and sobriety. Holidays and family gatherings have always been tough, Claudia said. When Amy does show up, you never know what you're in for. If she's drinking, it always ends up in an altercation with my parents. When she doesn't show up, my parents' grief hangs over the house. Either way, no one wants to talk about it. It's the elephant in the room. One time, Amy did show up, sober and on her best behavior. Claudia's then-fiancé and his family had joined them for dinner, and Claudia's father gave a rousing speech about how grateful they were to have Amy with them for the weekend. During the speech, Claudia and her other sister Anna exchanged glances that clearly conveyed their hurt and frustration. Amy's struggle consumed and defined their family, often making Claudia and Anna feel like there wasn't much energy or attention left for anyone else. Amy had texted Claudia a couple days before she arrived in Madison, saying she was looking forward to seeing her and hoped they could get together without their parents. Thanksgiving dinner without Amy was difficult, and, as Claudia had predicted, her parents were sad, but there was no conversation about Amy's absence. The night before she was to return to Chicago, Claudia and Anna went to meet Amy for dinner. "I thought we could just have one meal together," Claudia told me. "Three sisters sharing a pizza and catching up, like a normal family." Amy texted Claudia the address where she was staying, but as Claudia and Anna approached, they began to think they'd made a mistake. The address, in a high-crime part of town, was an abandoned store. There was plywood covering the broken windows, and the rotting door was slightly ajar. Claudia and Anna walked up to the door and peeked inside. When they saw a shadowy figure toward the back of the store, they looked at each other and decided to get back in the car. But before they could turn around, Amy called out, "Come in." Fear washed over Claudia when she finally saw Amy in the dim light of the small apartment upstairs where she was staying. She looked worse than ever. She was dirty, disheveled, and had dark circles under her eyes. The room was full of trash, and as they stood there staring at Amy, a mouse ran across the floor. Claudia was overwhelmed by pain at the sight of Amy and her suffering. Claudia explained to me, "5 years ago, I would have asked myself when I saw Amy, is she drunk or sober? But this far into her disease, she doesn't have to be drunk for you to know she's suffering. Even when she's sober, you can tell she's sick." Anna was also overwhelmed by her sister's appearance, but unlike Claudia, she was not speechless. Echoing words they'd heard their father say many times, Anna shouted, "What is wrong with you? How can you live like this? Jesus, pull yourself together." The whole scene was traumatic. Amy became agitated and insisted that Anna leave right away. After a few minutes of negotiating, Anna caught a cab home. Claudia stayed with Amy, and for the next 2 hours, Amy unloaded on Claudia, who did her very best to listen while Amy told her how miserable she was and complained about their parents' unfair treatment and expectations. Claudia was overcome with grief and guilt. Grief for her sister and guilt for thinking, "How long do I have to stay here and listen to this? When can I leave? How soon can I get back to the life I've worked so hard to build in Chicago?" Claudia told me, "Initially, I thought my face-down moment was sitting in that terrible place across from my sister, who was as bad off as I've ever seen her. But it wasn't. I wasn't curious about what I was feeling. I just wanted to stop feeling it. I didn't want to know more. I wanted to get out of there and go back to Chicago." At one point, Amy said to Claudia, "You're the only one in the family who really understands me. I know you can help me. You can make everything better. I'll come live with you in Chicago. You can take care of me." Claudia instantly felt guilt, but also panic. She told Amy that she could and would stay more connected and would help her, but moving in with her would not work. Amy's struggle had started when the girls were all teenagers. Claudia's entire family life had been hijacked by Amy's addiction. Claudia wasn't willing to jeopardize her marriage and her life. After another hour of conversation, Claudia left and drove back to her parents' house. She knew her parents would be waiting up when she got home, hoping for a full report. But Claudia couldn't bring herself to talk about it. It was too hard, too awful. They asked, but she said nothing. The three of them sat in silence and watched TV for an hour. Claudia was so glad she was leaving the next morning. On the quick flight from Madison to Chicago, Claudia convinced herself that the best way to get on with her life was to leave this painful experience behind her. She wasn't even going to share what had happened with her husband. "I'm so tired of being that person," she told me. "The one with the crazy family. The one that, instead of having the kind of Thanksgiving dinner you see in the movies, visits her alcoholic sister in a rodent-infested abandoned store." As Claudia rode the train home from the airport, a fistfight broke out in the aisle between the seats. All of a sudden, two large men were going at it, punching, shoving, and pulling hair. The train was full of families carrying shopping bags stuffed with post-Thanksgiving Day bargains. Some of the people on the train were yelling, "Stop! There are children here! Stop fighting!" The two men were still fighting when the train finally reached the next station. The passengers all made beelines for the platform, many of them calling for the police as they pushed their way past the brawling men. The reckoning. Already feeling tender from her experiences with her family, Claudia was shaken by the fight on the train. "It affected me in a powerful way," she said. "I know it sounds crazy, but there was something almost metaphysical about it. It was as if the universe were telling me that I can't run from a conflict because it'll just follow me. This was my reckoning. Something about this violent fight. I think this was my face-down moment. I didn't know what I was feeling or why, but I knew that something was happening here, something I had to understand better." Claudia decided she would tell her husband about her visit and Amy's situation. He was grateful that she shared it with him, and they agreed that they wouldn't keep difficult things like that from each other. Claudia told me that her initial impulse not to tell her husband was part of her SFD. The story I made up starts with the questions I ask every year as the holidays approach. Why can't I just go home and have a normal visit? Is it too much to ask to just grab some pizza with my sisters over the Thanksgiving holiday? The experience is always disappointing at best and intensely painful at worst. I resent that it's always so hard. Also, I make up that if I spend more time with Amy and try to support her and love her, I'll get sucked in and somehow end up taking care of her for the rest of our lives. And I know what that looks like. She's almost 30 years old. Short of having her committed, what can I do if she refuses to get help? I know I can't take care of her. On the other hand, if I don't take care of her or I limit my time with her, I'm a bad sister. I also make up that if we don't talk about what's happening, it's easier. And if I don't talk about it with my husband, I can keep it away from the life I've built. There's also the fear that if I do talk about it with my husband, he'll think something's wrong with me and my family. The rumble. When I asked Claudia where she was in the process, she said, "I'm definitely still in Act Two. I know I need to rumble with my expectations about time with my family. I don't know why I keep thinking that things might somehow be different the next time I go home. It's always hard, and I keep experiencing the same disappointment over and over. I'm not even sure where I came up with the idea that normal holidays exist for anyone. But at the same time, it's hard to give up my fantasy of a normal family and to accept that visits with my sister will always be difficult. Just getting clear on how I'm setting myself up to go in is a big start." Claudia explained, "I'm also rumbling with connection. It was hard to talk about what happened with my husband. When I finally told him the part about coming home and watching TV in silence with my parents, rather than discussing what had happened with Amy, he pointed out how disconnected the three of us were and how that only makes things worse. I know that's true. We don't know how to talk about it in my family. I think my whole family is rumbling with heartbreak, and we're afraid that opening up that discussion will mean being overcome with sadness. But not talking about it isn't working either. As Claudia thought more about the new story she wants to write, she said, "What I do know for sure is that I love my sisters and my parents. I can't worry about being the person with the crazy family. I know so many people who have a parent or sibling suffering with mental illness or addiction, or both. I need to work on owning this story. Moving away and limiting my time at home doesn't change the fact that this is part of my life. I'm also rumbling with boundaries. Sacrificing my life won't make Amy better. I can be a good sister and still set boundaries around my life. I need to figure out how to do that. I'm still rumbling." Claudia then shared one of the most powerful insights about the process that I've ever heard. She said, "It's so hard to be face down on the arena floor. But if you open your eyes when you're down there and take a minute to look around, you get a completely new perspective on the world. You see things that you don't see when you're standing tall. You see more struggle, more conflict and suffering. It can make you more compassionate if you open your eyes and look around while you're down there." I'm grateful for Claudia's willingness to let me share this story for several reasons. First, it takes courage to share a story that's still in process, to say, "I'm still in the rumble, still trying to figure out what's true and what's not." Sometimes SFDs are written over the course of years. It may take a long time to challenge and reality check our narratives. Second, I've never met a single person who hasn't had to rumble with expectations, disappointment, and resentment. It's a standing rumble for most of us. Third, we all experience different kinds of heartbreak over the course of our lives, but the heartbreak associated with addiction and mental, behavioral, and physical health struggles is not something we talk about enough. We need to have more conversations about the protracted heartbreak that stems from feeling helpless as we watch someone we love suffer, even as that suffering pulls us down. Last, our silence about grief serves no one. We can't heal if we can't grieve. We can't forgive if we can't grieve. We run from grief because loss scares us. Yet our hearts reach toward grief because the broken parts want to mend. C.S. Lewis wrote, "No one ever told me that grief felt so like fear." We can't rise strong when we're on the run. Rumbling with disappointment, expectations, and resentment. Often stories of falling are threaded with sadness, frustration, or anger, describing something that, for some reason, just didn't turn out the way we hoped it would. We need to examine our story for phrases like, "I had my heart set on it," or "I counted on this happening," or "I just thought." If expressions like these show up, we might be struggling with disappointment. Here's what you need to know about disappointment. Disappointment is unmet expectations. And the more significant the expectations, the more significant the disappointment. The way to address this is to be upfront about our expectations by taking time to reality check what we're expecting and why. Expectations often coast along right under our radar, making themselves known only after they have bombed something we had high hopes for into rubble. I call these stealth expectations. Claudia recognized her stealth expectations when it came to going home for a visit with her family. For example, the idea that she should be able to have a normal night out with her sisters over pizza. If your story is full of question marks, places where you have scribbled, huh? Or what just happened? Or was that too much to ask? It is likely a story of stealth expectations and the disappointment they have produced. As Anne Lamott said, expectations are resentments waiting to happen. We have the tendency to visualize an entire scenario or conversation or outcome, and when things don't go the way we'd imagined, disappointment can become resentment. This often happens when our expectations are based on outcomes we can't control, like what other people think, what they feel, or how they're going to react. For example, it's going to be a great holiday. My sister-in-law is going to love her gift and be so impressed with dinner. Or, I can't wait to share my project ideas with the team tomorrow. They're going to be blown away. For Steve and me, stealth expectations, disappointment, and resentment have been the sources of some of our most difficult arguments. About 5 years ago, we noticed a pattern where one of us would slip into resentment after a weekend of trying to jointly juggle our family's hectic soccer, birthday party, sleepover, school project, church schedules, along with our own personal plans. It's so much easier when we were flying solo. But how on earth could it be easier for Steve to hold down the fort when I'm out of town? Why is it simpler for me to navigate a busy weekend when he's on call and at the hospital for hours on end? Our arguments after weekends together always ended with one of us feeling resentment and going into blaming mode. You're not helpful. You don't add anything. You just make it harder. It was so painful. I finally said to Steve, I am tired of this argument about it being easier without the other one here. It totally hurts my feelings. I feel like I don't belong here. Something about the story we're telling ourselves is not true. I don't believe it. So we started rumbling on the stories behind these arguments. It took a lot of trial and error and several near meltdowns until Steve finally said, when it's just me with the kids, I have no expectations for getting my own stuff done. I give up my to-do list. It was that simple. This fight was all about stealth expectations. When I'm on my own for a weekend with the kids, I clear the expectations deck. When Steve and I are both home, we set all kinds of wild expectations about getting stuff done. What we never do is make those expectations explicit. We just tend to blame each other for our disappointment when they're not realized. Now, before weekends, vacations, or even busy school or work weeks, we talk about expectations. That doesn't mean stealth expectations no longer trip me up. In 2014, we were packing for spring break at Disney World when Steve, who was looking in my bag, said, "Should we reality check expectations for the week?" I gave him a tight-lipped smile, my, "Oh, that's so sweet, but I've got this" grin, and replied, "No, I think we're good, babe." Steve pointed to the three novels I had stuffed into my carry-on bag and said, "Tell me about those." As I started to explain how I wanted to sleep late, relax, and read three good mysteries over the course of our week away, I suddenly heard what I was saying. Who was I kidding? We were going to be at Disney World with five kids for 7 days. The only thing I'd be reading was the sign that said, "You must be this tall to ride." Sure enough, we were out the door by 8 o'clock every morning of that vacation, and I didn't read a thing, but we had a great time once I had reality checked my expectations. I've heard people say that disappointment is like a paper cut. Painful, but not long-lasting. I do believe we can heal disappointment, but it's important not to underestimate the damage it inflicts on our spirit. I recently watched the magnificent Japanese animated film, Spirited Away. There's a scene in the film where a young boy named Haku, who has taken the form of a dragon, is being attacked by a relentless swarm of birds. The attackers are actually origami birds, and they cut into Haku, leaving him battered and bloodied. Disappointments may be like paper cuts, but if those cuts are deep enough, or if there are enough of them, they can leave us seriously wounded. Rumbling with disappointment, resentment, and expectations is essential. These experiences permeate every aspect of our personal and professional lives. A lifetime of unexplored disappointments can make us bitter, and stored up resentment is toxic. Nelson Mandela wrote, "Resentment is like drinking poison and then hoping it will kill your enemies." Wholeheartedness requires being conscious of the litany of expectations that hum along below the surface so we can reality check our thinking. This process can lead to stronger and deeper relationships and connections. Rumbling with love, belonging, and heartbreak. Heartbreak is more than just a particularly hard form of disappointment or failure. It hurts in an entirely different way because heartbreak is always connected to love and belonging. Over time, the more I've thought about heartbreak and love, the more clearly I've realized how vulnerable we are when we love anyone. The brokenhearted are the bravest among us. They dared to love. When I ran this idea by my dear friend and mentor, Joe Reynolds, an Episcopal priest and one of the wisest people I know, he was quiet for a while, then said, "Yes, I do think heartbreak is about love. I just want to think about it some more." A couple of days later, he sent me a letter sharing his thoughts, and he gave me permission to include it here. Joe writes, "Heartbreak is an altogether different thing. Disappointment doesn't grow into heartbreak, nor does failure. Heartbreak comes from the loss of love or the perceived loss of love. My heart can be broken only by someone or something like my dog, though a part of me really believes my dog is a person, to whom I have given my heart. There may be expectations both met and unmet in a relationship that ends in heartbreak, but disappointment is not the cause of heartbreak. There may be failures within the relationship. Indeed, there certainly will be, for we are imperfect vessels to hold the love of another person. But the failures didn't cause the heartbreak. Heartbreak is what happens when love is lost. Heartbreak can come from being rejected by the one you love. The pain is more intense when you thought the other person loved you. But the expectation of returned love isn't necessary for heartbreak. Unrequited love can be heartbreaking. The death of a loved one is heartbreaking. I didn't expect them to live forever, and death is nobody's fault, regardless of smoking, bad diets, no exercise, or whatever. But my heart is broken anyway. A related heartbreak is the death of something unique, maybe even essential, in someone I love. I didn't want my children to stay children all of their lives. But at times, the loss of innocence was heartbreaking. The loss of love doesn't have to be permanent to be heartbreaking. Moving away from a loved one can break your heart. Change in another person I love may be a good thing. It may be significant personal growth, and I may be happy about it and proud of it. It can also change our relationship and break my heart. The list goes on. There is a plethora of ways in which a heart can be broken. The common denominator is the loss of love or perceived loss of love. To love with any level of intensity and honesty is to become vulnerable. I used to tell couples getting married that the only thing I could tell them with certainty was that they would hurt each other. To love is to know the loss of love. Heartbreak is unavoidable unless we choose not to love at all. A lot of people do just that. The message in Joe's beautiful letter is the first thing to know if you're rumbling with heartbreak in your story. Heartbreak is what happens when love is lost. As Joe points out and as Claudia's story illustrates, the loss of love doesn't have to be permanent or even tangible. It can be love that's been lost to suffering, to addiction, or to any struggle that takes away our capacity to practice love and to receive it. There are two reasons why most of us are slow to acknowledge that what we're feeling is heartbreak. The first is that we normally associate heartbreak with romantic love. This limiting idea keeps us from fully owning our stories. The greatest heartbreaks of my life include the loss of what I knew as my family after my parents' divorce, watching my mom's pain after my uncle was killed, loving someone struggling with trauma and addiction issues, and losing my grandmother, first to Alzheimer's and then to death. The second reason we don't acknowledge heartbreak is its association with one of the most difficult emotions in the human experience, grief. If what I'm experiencing is heartbreak, then grieving is inevitable. Rumbling with grief. As someone who has spent close to 15 years studying the emotional landscape of the human experience, I can tell you that grief is perhaps the emotion we fear the most. As individuals, we're afraid of the darkness grief brings. As a society, we have pathologized it and turned it into something to cure or get over. Owning our stories of heartbreak is a tremendous challenge when we live in a culture that tells us to deny our grief. There are many helpful books about the nature of grief and the grieving process. Many of these resources are based on research. But some of the most profoundly healing books are memoirs by people who have courageously shared their own stories. I have a full list of both in the library on my website, brenebrown.com. What I want to share here is what I've learned about grief from the research. Specifically, the three most foundational elements of grief that emerge from my studies. Loss, longing, and feeling lost. Loss. While death and separation are tangible losses associated with grief, some of the participants described losses that are more difficult to identify or describe. These included the loss of normality, the loss of what could be, the loss of what we thought we knew or understood about something or someone. Grief seems to create losses within us that are beyond our awareness. We feel as if we're missing something that was invisible and unknown to us while we had it, but is now painfully gone. In the moving novel, The Fault in Our Stars, John Green captures one of those secret losses that accompanies grief. He writes, "The pleasure of remembering had been taken from me, because there was no longer anyone to remember with. It felt like losing your co-rememberer meant losing the memory itself, as if the things we'd done were less real and important than they had been hours before." This quote grabbed me because until I read it, I wasn't able to articulate one of the losses that I still feel from my parents' divorce. Funny memory shared with both my parents. I know the event still happened, but my parents and I are no longer co-rememberers in the way we once were. For Claudia, the fact that her sister's addiction and depression consume her family means that buried within her heartbreak is the loss of her parents. The feeling that her relationship with them is diminished or overshadowed by their preoccupation with her sister. Holidays and family gatherings are good if Amy's doing okay, and they're undercut by sadness and anger if she's a no-show or arrives clearly impaired. It's easy to understand why parents focus on the child who is struggling, especially when the other children seem to be doing well. But over the years, I've heard many participants in my research talk about the feelings of grief and loss they experience in similar situations.